This is a tough crowd, but I get an hour to just talk and you can't talk, so everybody's going to have to wait till the question period. I'm glad to be here and I appreciate the invitation. I have to apologize to begin with. I'm that guy that didn't get my outline in on time, so everybody that was waiting on it, my apologies to you. Hope that we can still be friends after this is over. I'd never like being the speaker right after lunch either, so wake up. Hopefully we can all keep ourselves from dozing off. As we look at this particular topic, Greg and Kevin and I and Alan were having a discussion right after the last discussion period before going over to lunch. And in a study like this, a lot of times we're trying to convey what we've studied and share it with other people. And one of the first points that Kyle made was the difficulty of communication. And I have to tell you that, you know, in my work as a gospel preacher, this is something that I think a lot of people take for granted, and I think that you can relate to this too. We may have a lot of knowledge about a subject, but it's like a dump truck dumped it on our desk. I've got all of this stuff, but to be able to organize it and formulate it in my mind to be able to communicate that in these vehicles of thought called words to where you really understand my mind, that's the hard part, for me at least. And what I fail to do sometimes is to accurately convey that. I'm in a hurry to get this information across, but did I actually get it across in the format that is going to make sense? I'm saying all that because I was thinking last night and even this morning as I was looking over my notes that what we've been doing all day yesterday and in Greg's lesson this morning is we have been in the negative as it relates to a debate. We've been taking the arguments that are posed in favor of social drinking and seeking to show that they're not valid, that what they believe that these passages teach, they do not teach that, or at least that it's not necessarily implied. And so I want you to realize that the greater part of this study that I'll be going through this afternoon is taking these six passages that have been put forth to suggest that they do teach or provide authority for social drinking. And I'm not making an argument per se. These are not my passages, or it's not my argument. What I'm seeking to do is to show you why I believe that we're not forced to that conclusion, that their argument is not valid, that it doesn't stand. Now, as I get to the end of my study, which I probably won't have time, but what Doy will be doing is really making the affirmative, why we believe that it is wrong, or at least for some of us. And let me also say, many of you I don't know, other than, you know, casually meeting some of you here last year and then here this time. So I really don't know what your feelings are on it unless you've expressed it to me here. So this is another thing that is a challenge for us when we speak and we teach on a lesson. If I'm preaching to a group of people that believe what I believe is the truth, I'm going to convey that in a way to try to express confidence in that truth. However, if I'm having a Bible study with someone that does not even share the same view as me, they disagree with me, I'm going to take a much different approach to that. And so this is what makes it hard when I don't really know where you might be. So my tendency is to take that approach to give you confidence that this is right. But sometimes that's not the best approach. And what I need to be doing is stepping back. And you know what Kevin's done a good job of is to test these arguments to make sure that we're not overreaching. And I'm very conscientious of that when I'm studying with someone that doesn't agree with me. If I'm studying with somebody that says, I know that there's something wrong about this, but, you know, what are the passages? Where is all this coming from? I'm going to approach it with maybe more confidence, I guess you'd say. I don't know if I'm conveying that well, but I just want you to understand as we're going through this, I'm not trying to prove necessarily what Acts 2 is saying. I'm simply showing that it doesn't teach authority for social drinking, or Ephesians 5:18, and so on. Is that clear? All right, so as we go through this particular study, and what I've been assigned to do is to look at wine in the early church, in the New Testament age, I won't be spending a lot of time defining words. I've provided some supplemental definitions out of necessity, but really Kyle's lesson would take care of a lot of that, and we can cover it in the discussion if we need to. One of the things that we've got to understand is that the child of God must have authority for everything that he does. Colossians 3:17, whatever you do in word or in deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father through him. You know, I think that for maybe some of us, we have at times maybe felt a little worn out with an approach to everything based on authority. At least in my generation, I heard so many sermons on authority going through institutionalism, or at least maybe even on the tail end of that, that there are times when I think, I want to take a different approach to that. And this is one of those subjects for me that I wasn't really confident or sure that the arguments that had been made were that strong. My view of it when I was younger is that I don't think those are very good arguments. I think that preacher's just against drinking. I felt the same way about dancing. I felt the same way about a lot of lessons on modest apparel. So what I've had to do is to go back and to reinvestigate for it to be my faith. And on all three of these, I believe that I have strong, solid, substantial evidence for where I stand. I don't make all the same arguments that I heard necessarily growing up, but I believe that the truth is there. And I believe that it is sound and it is valid to approach everything that we do in word or in deed with what saith the Lord. When one of my closest friends, best man at my wedding, grew up with him. He came out to Lubbock to visit me, and a close friend of his, a gospel preacher, had taken the position that social drinking was authorized, and it devastated Steve. And he said, Brett, I need to study with you. I need to work through this. I'm trying to communicate with him. So as we sat down and we studied, I was making the arguments that I'd made. I had not been forced to make a lot of arguments on it. And Steve kept coming back to, well, where is it authorized? And I was a little bit annoyed with it. I said, well, you know, that's to do with institutionalism. You know, that's to do with instrumental music. Let's go over here and look at this passage and look at this passage. But the more that I went through it and the more that I thought about this issue, I realized Steve's not wrong. We have to have authority for everything that we do, not just in church action. That may be a subject for discussion. I think that there's a lot of brethren that have not reached that conclusion. And a lot of the folks that are taking the position that social drinking is authorized, consequently, have been weak on other matters of Bible authority. I'm not saying that they all are. I think it's important that we come back to this principle and make sure that everything that we do has the authority of God. And what we mean by that is there must be either a command, a direct statement, an approved example, or a necessary implication for what we are going to practice and what we're going to preach. Now, that's not Alexander Campbell doctrine. Jesus used that very method of biblical interpretation. The apostles and the elders used it in Acts chapter 15. It's sound. That's something that we would have to discuss in another study. And another thing that I've had to realize is that the burden of proof is not upon me to prove that something is expressly or explicitly forbidden. That's not our responsibility. The responsibility is on the person who has the practice or the doctrine to prove where it is positively, divinely approved or authorized. Let's not forget that. That's my approach in this study. Revelation chapter 20, I may not know everything that figure means. I know what it doesn't mean. It doesn't teach a 1,000-year reign of Jesus in Jerusalem. And so I don't have to know every detail about what is taught in that figure in Revelation 20. But when I take the arguments for premillennialism, I compare them with the harmony of Scripture. It is also written. It has to be in harmony with everything else. It won't work. It won't fit. And so that's my approach to this study in these six passages. I don't have to know whether or not the wine was alcoholic in every one of these places. What I'm examining is it a sound argument, biblically, that it is authorized in these passages. So there may be some discussion on that as well. These are the six passages we'll be looking at, and I chose the order in which to address them just out of my own preference. And as we look at these passages, we obviously want to receive the word with all readiness. Honest hearts are required to have an open mind, even to an argument that I'm uncomfortable with or I haven't thought through that before. I think all of us have felt that a little bit in this study. That's why we're here. Receive it with all readiness. That's a readiness to study and a readiness to obey and a readiness to possibly suffer for that truth when we take a stand for it. And then we also need to be willing to test all things and hold fast that which is good. So let's begin the test. In Acts 2 and in verse 13, others mocking said, "They are full of new wine." But Peter, standing up with the 11, raised his voice and said to them, "Men of Judea and all who dwell in Jerusalem, let this be known to you and heed my words, for these are not drunk as you suppose, since it is only the third hour of the day." In verse 13, they were accused by mockers of being full of new wine. Peter answers their assertion by saying that they are not drunk. Now, there's a lot of context to this, and it's in the outline. I know I was late getting it out. I hope that you'll download it if you don't already have it and look through that, and maybe you'll find some things you want to discuss there. Suffice it to say that a miracle was performed of tongue speaking. It astonished most of the people, and there were some Jews there that, for whatever reason, instead of honestly investigating what was this, they chose to mock. And this word is defined by Thayer and by Bedag and others as to engage in mockery, to make fun of, to maliciously jeer, and so on. Did they really believe that they were drunk? You know, here's a lot of things we can speculate on. I think it's very likely that what they were doing is they were using an absurdity to make fun of them. But do I know that? I don't. Here's the bottom line. Peter addressed the accusation of drunkenness. I don't know what those mockers believed. I don't have to know. Peter addressed the issue of drunkenness, and so that's certainly something that we need to address ourselves. Were they, does this provide then positive divine authority for social drinking? Again, remember that we've got to have a command, a direct statement, an approved example, or a necessary inference to authorize social drinking or moderate consumption of an intoxicating beverage. And let me point this out, because I've found that folks in thinking through this don't always make an accurate statement about this. We don't have to have all four of those. We don't even have to have one, or we don't even have to have more than one. All we have to have is one of those forms, and it's authorized. That's what we're looking for. So there's certainly no command or direct statement. There's no approved example of social drinking anywhere in this context. So the only thing that might possibly be here would be necessary implication, and that's what some would argue, is the fact that Peter did not deny drinking. He just denied that they were drunk. And so some would argue that because Peter did not deny drinking, he only denied being drunk, that it is necessarily implied that they did drink intoxicating wine. Let's put that argument to the test. Again, in order for a thing to be necessarily implied, it must in fact be necessary to infer what was necessarily implied. And I don't remember which one of the old-time preachers it was, but I remember growing up, and one of those preachers and one of those many, many sermons on Bible authority I heard, he explained it this way. And actually, I remember the first time that I used this was when I was over in Africa preaching, and you had the barrier of language, and you're having to use an interpreter. And when I talked about necessary implication, my interpreter said, "We don't have that word in this particular language." And I had to figure out, how do I convey to them what necessary implication is? And I went back to that illustration where the preacher said, "My pocket knife is in my right hand, and my right hand is in my right pocket. Now, which pocket is my knife in?" I have not explicitly stated that, but I have necessarily implied or implicitly stated that my knife is in my right pocket. Why? Because it can't be any other way. if A is true and B is true, C must be true. If my knife's in my right hand, my right hand's in my right pocket, my knife has to be in my right pocket. That's what necessary implication is. We're not saying it's strongly implied, or I think it's implied. We're saying it can't be any other way. So make sure that you realize that's the case that has to be made to authorize it in any one of these passages. Now, if this is true, that Peter only denied being drunk, he didn't deny drinking, therefore they must drink intoxicating wine, I'm going to test the argument. I'm not arguing that this is true. I'm saying that to take that argument, this is a logical consequence that would be attached to it. Peter also didn't deny being drunk after the third hour of the day. He only denied that they weren't drunk because it was not the appropriate time to be drunk. About 9 o'clock, some argued that it was 10 o'clock. I think it was probably closer to 9. But the point is, he didn't deny getting drunk later. Does that mean then that they drank later? Well, you say, well, no, the Bible condemns that. I know, but neither would his statement here even necessarily imply that if we didn't have the other passages. This is not a valid approach. What he didn't say does not necessarily imply this. John chapter 7, verse 20, and there's a typo in the outline. I think I've got John 10, 20, so make sure that you make note of that. It's John 7 and verse 20. They said of Jesus, he has a demon. Now, there were some occasions where Jesus denied it. On this occasion, he did not deny it. All he did was go back and show the problem with why they were saying such an absurd thing about him. Their hearts were corrupt, but he didn't deny having a demon. Does that mean that he was demon-possessed? God forbid. This is not necessarily implied when a person doesn't say what we think that they need to give a litany of every reason. It does not necessarily imply every reason that they didn't give. Peter gave the reason that was best suited for the mockers. Whether they were making fun of them or if they really believed that they were drunk. Here's what Peter did. Even if they were making fun of him, sometimes maybe you've had someone that they're not even making it a serious argument. They're just trying to destroy your validity in somebody's eyes. They're making a joke about you, making fun of you. Maybe a denominational person, you know, well, you know, you think you're the only ones that's going to be saved or whatever. Maybe they're making, you don't believe in music. What Peter did is he just took a serious approach to it, and he took that argument that they made, tossed it away with logic and reason, and it stopped their mouths. There wasn't anything else that they could do. So Peter made the reason that was best suited for the mockers. He did not have to give every reason that was necessary or every reason why he did not, why they weren't drunk or why they didn't drink. He just gave the one that was best suited. He didn't have to list every reason. There it is. Somebody says, well, where does the Bible say not to? Where does the Bible say not to? You know, this is really essentially the argument that's made when someone says Peter didn't say they didn't drink. We're basing something on his silence there. And it is the idea that silence gives consent. It does not. Let's look at a couple of passages here. In Acts chapter 15, when the Judaizing teachers went out and preached that the Gentiles must be circumcised and keep the law, here's the way that the apostles and elders answer that. In Acts 15, 24, since we have heard that some who went out from us have troubled you with words, unsettling your souls, saying you must be circumcised and keep the law, to whom we gave no such commandment. He didn't say we told them not to say that. He said there is no authority for what they're teaching. That's the idea. They gave no silence does not imply consent. In Matthew 28 and verse 20, Jesus said, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I've commanded you. Hebrews 7 and verse 14, there's not a passage that says that one of the tribe of Judah cannot be a priest. It authorizes the Levites. And the silence, according to the writer of Hebrews, necessarily implied that one from the tribe of Judah could not be a priest. Silence does not imply consent. That's the point that we're looking at here. A thing does not have to be explicitly condemned in order for it to be sinful, it just has to be not authorized. We understand that in a lot of different areas, just like this. Now, was the glucose wine in this particular, or was the glucose intoxicating, rather, in this particular passage, really not an issue for me, okay? Because whether it was or not, Peter answered the issue of being drunk. I don't know if they were making fun, if they really believed. Peter said, these men are not drunk. So that's what has to be dealt with, is whether or not that statement necessarily implies that they drank intoxicating wine. Just for fun's sake, I think that we've already looked at this word glucose to a certain degree, but this word translated new wine is glucose, and you'll see there it's translated in a number of different ways. Thayer says it was must, the sweet juice pressed from the grape, Bedag, sweet new wine, commonly referred to as must, and the LEH lexicon says that it was sweet new wine. All right? Now, all of the arguments that say that it couldn't have been because of the vintage time are simply an approach to it that disbelieves that wine could be preserved, and I believe that that has been proven there. The word, and this is, I want us to notice, the word simply means sweet wine. The fermentation or the lack thereof of that wine was not a part of the meaning. And you will notice that Thayer, Bedag, and the LEH lexicon, they simply defined the word without commentary. Not in every case do they do that, but in this case they did. They just gave a definition. But Strong and Vine add their commentary after the simple definition of the word. Strong and Vine give the same simple definition. Then they add their commentary because they're bringing their personal views into it. I just want the definition of the word. What does it mean? And what it means is simply sweet wine. And so we've got to stay with that. And I think it's also worthwhile to note that the word is translated new wine in the New King James, King James, ESV, the ASV. What is that? I don't know exactly how many translators, but 320 or so men, very good Greek scholars, and they define it, and they know the time at which this was written. They call it new wine. The New American Standard Bible calls it sweet wine. The NIV simply says wine without anything there. My point is, you know, if that many Greek scholars are going to say that it means sweet new wine, I'm going to stick with that. But again, I don't have to prove anything on that. The fact that Peter denied being drunk does not necessarily imply that they were drinkers of intoxicating wine. It doesn't have to be that way. All right, Romans chapter 14, verse 21. It is good neither to eat meat nor drink wine, nor do anything by which your brother stumbles or is offended or is made weak. Here he speaks about drinking wine. This is a thorough context, and you'll have to read comments about this. But suffice it to say that what we're looking at here is a situation in Romans where Paul is dealing with problems that were created by Jews and Gentiles being redeemed and added to the same body. You're going to necessarily have some difficulties and some baggage that they both bring to the table when they've been converted out of their respective religions. The Jew being converted out of Judaism and or out from the law of Moses, and the Gentile being converted out of idolatry. They both had their baggage that they brought to the table. And so you had some Christians who had a very sensitive conscience at that particular time that was based upon past prohibitions in their religion. In 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10, which is a package, it's the whole context is dealing there with things offered to idols, deals, I believe, primarily toward the Gentile baggage of their past prohibitions, or at least of past experience in religion. I think that Romans 14 is probably dealing more with the Jewish past, with eating certain meats and with observing certain days. Again, I'm not dogmatic about that. I think that both of these are parallel passages. And what the problem was is you've got a person that is converted to Christ, and there is liberty in Christ in regard to certain things, but because of past prohibitions, their conscience is still uncomfortable with those. I made the statement in the outline that this is a case where where one's conscience has not caught up with their intellect. And I know not everyone agrees with me on that. I believe that these people knew that it was not wrong or sinful to do, but it felt sinful. Someone says, no. Well, Paul's telling them in this text that it's not sinful. How could they not know that? I believe they intellectually knew it, but it didn't feel right. And I personally had several things like that. I've had to concede, I can't say that that's wrong, but it sure feels wrong to me, and I can't do it. And I'm not going to give you a list of my things, but there are areas where we have a strong conscience because of our past. My parents taught me certain things that were stricter than what the Bible requires, and I didn't learn that until I was an adult. And I'll tell you, it still feels wrong for me. So this is a part of the baggage that they were dealing with. I've spent too much time on that. It's important for us to note that these were all matters of indifference to God. God had received the eater and the non-eater. He had received the one who observed the day and the one who did not observe the day. But this context does not in any way, shape, or form teach that God receives a person who is looser in their conscience or practice or doctrine than what the gospel requires. That's nothing to do with Romans 14. Romans 14 was dealing with people who were stricter or more restrictive than they had to be. And that's exactly what you have in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, 9, and 10. So let's not go to this passage to try to authorize something that God would not allow. Let us also point out that this context, whatever we believe about the wine in verse 21, has to fit this context. And the context is limited to all things that indeed are pure, verse 20. To nothing that is unclean of itself, verse 14. And to things that are good, verse 16. And things that can be done unto the Lord, verse 6. Everything that he's talking about there, whether you eat or don't eat, whether you observe the day or don't observe the day, it fits every one of these. So whatever we put in verse 21, or that we're not supposed to put anything in there, whatever we draw out of verse 21 has to fit within this context. Is there authority in this particular context for social drinking? The argument is that Paul mentioned wine with meat in a context that is dealing with things that God received. Therefore, it's necessarily implied that God has received or that we are authorized to use intoxicating wine. So, here is the argument. The problem with this is that it assumes what has not been proven. It assumes that the wine here, the oinos, contains alcohol or that it is intoxicating. So that's really what we've got to determine from Romans 14. If Romans 14, 21 contains alcohol, then there is at least that much substantiation for the argument. If it does not contain alcohol, the argument falls completely apart. There's nothing here that would authorize it. Is it alcoholic? The word itself doesn't tell us. We've already noticed that. The word oinos is used in a number of different ways, and we cannot know whether it is for sure. It is a general term, like groceries or fruit, and it simply means grape juice. Now, I know that may be, some say, well, wait a minute, it means grape juice. It is a general term. That, I believe that's something that Kyle has brought out in his, as he's dealt with the meaning of the word. What we find out is that it can be fermented or unfermented. It can have alcoholic content or not have alcoholic content, just like groceries can be of one sort or another sort, just like fruit can be of one type or of another type. It is a general word, and so we cannot know from the word itself. The context has to tell us whether or not it is intoxicating or if it is not. In order for this passage to necessarily imply or provide an approved example or direct statement, it would have to be alcoholic. So, it is, let me back up. I'm getting ahead of myself there. The context has to bear it out. Now, we look at the context. Someone says, well, how could it not be alcoholic? How could he be talking about grape juice? Well, again, let's look at the context. The context is dealing with people that had a more restrictive conscience than what God would require. And so it is, you've got a situation where they were more restrictive than they had to be. It is certainly possible And I believe, even likely, I'm not trying to prove a point, I'm just telling you this is a possibility, that there are some who would eat only vegetables, then it is not a far reach to say that there are some who would not drink grape juice. You know why? Because Timothy drank only water. That's what Paul said in 1 Timothy 5:23. No longer drink only water. Clearly, there were some Christians that drank only water. Timothy had to be exhorted to drink something else. We know that John the Baptizer drank no grape juice at all. I'm saying that this is a plausible, it is a reasonable thing that we put forth here. Because we're dealing with a situation where a person's conscience was stricter than it had to be. For instance, there are some that might see all of the lewdness and the lust and the immorality and immodesty that surrounds swimming pools. And I've known Christians that would tell me, we don't have a swimming pool. I don't think that a Christian ought to have a swimming pool. Are you telling me that that's sinful to have a swimming pool in your backyard, you know, fenced in? Well, no, I'm not going to say it's sinful. I just don't think a Christian ought to. Okay, well, let's be clear about our terminology. Make sure that you know you're saying exactly what you mean there. I can appreciate that, you know, that we may stay far enough away because we are we're troubled by this particular problem. This is what we're looking at in Romans 14. When they had a situation where, as Kyle was telling us, you would go into the marketplace and you would buy oinos, and there's no labeling, there is not necessarily the FDA and other things like that. There may have been times where you got some oinos that had alcoholic content or had fermentation and you didn't know it. I think it's perfectly reasonable. It is perfectly reasonable from this context that some would say, we're not going to even drink grape juice. We're going to drink only water, which goes to your point, Kyle, about the fact that the water wasn't so unsafe to drink that they had to put alcoholic beverage into it. You know, now, granted, Timothy had some stomach problems. I do realize that. And Paul told him to not drink water only, but he at least existed for a long time drinking water only. My point, and I don't want to distract, it is plausible that some would drink only grape juice. Now, let's get back to the context. If it is alcoholic, it has to fit within all things that are indeed are pure, nothing that is unclean of itself and good and something that can be done unto the Lord. So, in order for the wine mentioned here to fit within all of those, let me suggest this to you and you can test it. You may really scald me with this argument in our discussion. I believe that if alcohol fits in this context, then it would be proper for a father driving by a particular liquor store to tell his children as he drives by, everything of alcoholic beverage in that liquor store is indeed pure. Everything in that liquor store, nothing in there that's alcoholic beverage, is unclean of itself. As a matter of fact, all the alcoholic beverage in there is good. And I think somebody was saying today that there are some that are actually arguing that this is a blessing from God. And he would then be able to tell his child, I'm going to stop in there, get a 12-pack of Budweiser, and I'm going to drink one unto the Lord. Because whatever was being done in Romans 14 could be done. They could eat to the Lord or not eat to the Lord. This, I believe, is necessarily implied with whatever would fit within that particular context. And we would have no authority to refuse the dad who said this to his children or taught this to his children from membership or to withdraw from him. We would have to accept that. As we have said, what proves too much proves nothing at all. This is what we're doing is we're taking an argument to its logical consequence, and if its logical consequence is absurd or it proves too much more than what this person would want to accept, then we show that it's not valid. Reducto ad absurdum is the term. And I believe that that's what's done by trying to make alcoholic drink or intoxicating drink fit within the context that we find here. I know there will be more discussion on that. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and in verse 8. The text Likewise, deacons must be reverent, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, nor greedy for money. Now, the argument that's made here is as it pertains to verse 3. Verses 2 through 3, a bishop then must be blameless, husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, good behavior, hospitable, able to teach, not given to wine, not violent nor greedy for money, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous. So the argument then is that since an elder is told that he is not to be given to wine, but a deacon has said that he must not be given to much wine, then it is okay for a deacon to be given to a little wine, that he can drink some intoxicating drink. Well, again, let's put that to the test. There are two different words that are used in verse 3 and in verse 8. Now, I want you to note this if you're there in your Bible with me. What you have in verse 3, when he says about the elder that he is to not be given to wine, you have the word paroinos. I don't know how to, I'm not good at pronouncing these Greek terms. Can you pronounce that, Kyle? How would you say it?
Paroinos.
Thank you. Obviously, it comes from para and oinos. And so we've got a word here that Bedag or Artin Gingrich says, it pertains to one who is given to drinking too much wine, addicted to wine, or drunken. Some of the other lexicons will tell us it has to do with, all of them convey the idea of being addicted to wine and tarrying near, para, tarrying too long near the wine. But it is, even that, the implication of it is that they are given over to or that they are addicted to this particular wine. Now look down in verse 8. In verse 8, the word that we find is prosecco. Is that the right pronunciation of that? Did you say close enough? Close enough for a okie? All right. Prosecco. Artin Gingrich. To have in close proximity to, literally, of mental processes, to turn one's mind to. Now here's what's interesting to me. Notice that. Have in close proximity to. What did we say about paroinos, para, to tarry near, or to tarry close to? That's what a lot of the lexicographers tell us is conveyed behind that. Look at what Artin Gingrich say about this word. It means to have in close proximity to. And it is of mental processes to turn one's mind to. It's probably most commonly translated to give heed to, but it is to give one's mind over to. I don't know of a better synonym for being addicted to in this context when we're talking about wine. And so what I want you to realize is that what we have here is not different words teaching different qualifications. What we have is two different words that are synonymous. What Paul is doing as he's giving these qualifications is he's saying the same thing, he's just using synonyms. Has Paul ever done that? Well, he's the king of that. And I'm not just suggesting this. Let's look at it. Both of them convey the idea of being addicted to. Let's look at paroinos. This verse, this is all you have in this verse, in this qualification in verse 3. Not, and I don't know how to pronounce the Greek word for that, not paroinos. One word. And that one word means addicted to much wine. Okay? Now let's go down to verse 8. You have in that verse not prosecco, polis, I guess is the pronunciation, oinos. What does that mean? That means not prosecco, addicted to, polis, much, oinos, wine. So in verse 3, you have one word that says the exact same thing as three words in verse 8. These are not different words with different qualifications. He's saying the same thing. And so whatever it is not that an elder cannot have any and that a deacon can particularly have some. He's giving the same qualification for both of these men. Now, going back to the argument here is not sound anyway. Not only is this the same qualification, but the argument is a failure in an approach to biblical hermeneutics. It is an effort to authorize the moderate by the condemnation of the extreme or the excess. Let's notice some examples of that. James 1 and verse 21, he talks about the overflow of wickedness. The fact that he uses the term overflow Does that authorize moderate wickedness? Certainly not. The condemnation of the extreme or the excess does not, remember, necessarily imply where it has to be that way. Because if we're not talking about necessary implication, we might as well just get rid of this argument. If there's no necessary implication there, if it doesn't have to be that way, it's not an argument. It doesn't authorize. So what we would have to find is that when God condemns the extreme, that it is a consistent rule that he authorizes the moderate. It won't work. In Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 17, do not be overly wicked. He's not authorizing moderate wickedness. Romans 6 and verse 12, he's talking about not presenting your members as instruments of unrighteousness. He says, do not let sin reign in your body. Well, what if it doesn't reign, but it's just there? What if it's not in control? I just do it some, or I just commit sin moderately, but I'm still in control. We know that, again, that's an absurd position. It's all wrong. It's not that he's approving of moderate sin, but in this particular context, he's talking about the fact that this is what that leads to, is to where that sin reigns in your body. This is not a sound or a consistent hermeneutic or method of interpreting Scripture. Let's go on to Ephesians 5 and in verse 18. Do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit. Now, again, the text, we look at it within a context that begins really back in chapter 4, where he talks about putting off the old man, putting on the new. And in the beginning of chapter 5, he tells him to imitate God as dear children, and to cast off darkness, to walk as children of the light, to find out what is acceptable to the Lord, to walk circumspectly. Think about the implication of that word in relationship to getting loosened up with a drink or a couple of drinks socially. Circumspectly. Be wise and understand God's will and be filled with the Spirit. This is the context. And in that context, in verse 18, he gives the antithesis to all of this when he says, do not be drunk with wine. Because being drunk with wine is not only the antithesis to being filled with the Spirit, but I believe that we could show that it would be the antithesis to walking circumspectly, to being wise, how it affects the mind, to finding out what is acceptable to the Lord. How's that going to help one's interpretation of God's Word? Casting off darkness and walking as children, it's the antithesis to all of these. I don't need to prove that. Ephesians 5 and verse 18 then, is this authority for social drinking? Someone says, well, Paul's command to not be drunk stops short of requiring complete abstinence, and therefore moderate or social drinking is authorized. Well, once again, the failure is they're trying to authorize the moderate by condemnation of the extreme or the excess. We've already dealt with that. We've seen cases where that will not work in the last particular passage that we looked at. But also, I want us to think about the context. Would it be reasonable in this context for God to be authorizing the social consumption of something that he has already warned in inspired Scripture will bite like a serpent, sting like a viper, in Proverbs 31, cause one to lose wisdom and discernment? Would that even fit the context? I mean, I'm saying, here's the thing. We have to be intellectually honest as we deal with the context. Again, I'm not trying to prove something. I'm testing. I'm saying, is this a rational possibility? On several levels, it is not. But the bottom line is that it does not authorize because of the fact that it's an effort to authorize the moderate out of condemnation of the extreme. 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 21, and I'm glad, Greg, that you left this one with me, because after doing my outline, I do believe that it's fermented wine in the Lord's Supper now, so I get to teach. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. 1 Corinthians 11, 21, therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper, verse 21, for in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others. One is hungry and another is drunk. So here is a context where somebody might say, well, you know, They must have drank intoxicating wine if some were drunk. They believe that that's necessarily implied. Therefore, drinking intoxicating wine is approved of because Paul only condemned their drunkenness in this particular passage. First of all, here's another attempt to authorize the moderate by condemnation of the extreme of the excess. Because Paul condemned their drunkenness, he necessarily authorized moderate drinking. No. It's also an effort possibly to say, well, we know that they drank intoxicating wine in their assemblies because some of them were drunk. All right, let's look at that. In order for that to be true, it would have to be proven that it was intoxicating and that they were in fact inebriated. I know some would say, well, he said they were. He used the word methuel, which means to be drunk. But I want to tell you, if they were not actually intoxicated, the argument does not stand. It falls apart. Were they inebriated? Methuel certainly carries this meaning. Thayer says it means to be drunken, bedag, to drink to a point of intoxication. In every case, I don't believe that this is one. In most of the cases, like in Ephesians 5:18 that we just looked at, the word is used there to mean intoxication. But this Greek word is sometimes used to mean full or satiated. Greg was talking about this earlier. For instance, in Isaiah 34 and in verse 5, he says, "For my sword," this is the New American Standard Version, my sword is satiated in heaven. Some translations say, my sword is drunk. I knew I was going to dry out taking those antihistamines. Ezekiel 39 and verse 19, "So you will drink blood until you are drunk." You don't get intoxicated on blood. Obviously a metaphor. And he's talking about, I'm going to fill you up with this blood. You're going to drink so much of it that you're filled with it. Granted, it's a metaphor here, but it's clearly being used in relationship to something that does not intoxicate. And Isaiah 58 and 11, I think, is one that really was clear to me, you know, out of all of these especially. "The Lord will satisfy your soul in drought and strengthen your bones. You shall be like a watered, satiated, filled, drunk garden." Okay? What does it mean there? An intoxicated garden? No. It means filled to the full. When my wife asked me, "Brett, did you water the plants? Have they been satiated? Have they had sufficient water? Are they filled with what they need?" And this is the way that the word is used here. McKnight, in his commentary on the epistles, he said that this is the proper translation. One is hungry and another is filled. And then he comments, "So the Greek word, methuo, signifies here being opposed to one is hungry." The word is used in this sense by the Septuagint, and he goes on to cite some of those cases where that is particularly used. Now, what we need to understand is that the word means to be filled or to be full. Now, without question, if in the context it's dealing with alcoholic wine, then if a person is filled or full of intoxicating wine, yes, they are inebriated. Yes, they're intoxicated. But if it's something that is not intoxicating, they could be filled or full with it without being intoxicated. That obviously goes without saying. But what we've seen is that the word can be used in regard to things that are not intoxicating, in which it doesn't imply intoxication. So let's look at this context. The context is not about inebriation, about revelry, or about debauchery. It's about an inconsiderate selfishness, favoritism, and divisiveness. And like I said, I've got a lot about the context in my outline that I didn't have time to talk about here. So methuo is used in contrast to hungry. We're just looking at the contrast. One is hungry, another is drunk. And it means here full or satiated. They were not literally drunk in the sense of inebriation, and therefore there is nothing in the context that would authorize social drinking. Again, I realize this word methuo is used to mean intoxicated when in relation to intoxicating wine. But that intoxicating wine has to first be proven to force to the conclusion that methuo here is inebriation. And that can't be proven. I'm not saying that I can prove that it wasn't. I don't have to prove that it wasn't. I have to show that it cannot be, that it is not necessarily so that it was alcoholic wine and inebriation. There is another reasonable, plausible interpretation of this particular word. It's not my argument. I'm simply showing that it is not necessarily implied. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 23. No longer drink only water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities. Authority, that's it? Okay. We'll talk more about that probably in the discussion period.